With a little help, I think the first three movements sort themselves out pretty well. But the last movement, this really is a problem. It's so huge, longer than virtually any classical symphony. I wouldn't expect anybody to get this movement, at least until you've heard it many times. On first hearing, and probably on second and third as well, it may seem like an immense, impenetrable wall of sound, often cacophonous and absolutely unpretty. But what an overwhelming impact. There are a couple of ways of looking at the form of it. First, it's in sonata form. The trouble with that is that I wonder if anyone really hears it that way. I certainly don't. When I conduct it, I'm not saying to myself, "Ah, here's the primary theme, here comes the secondary theme." When I'm conducting the Beethoven Fifth, I am hearing it that way, but not when I'm conducting the Mahler Sixth. The sonata idea provides an organizing coherence that operates behind the scenes, as it were, but it's not necessary that you be conscious of how it works. I think it may be clearer if you think of it as being organized around the three great hammer blows that provide the climaxes in the movement. The hammer that Mahler calls for in the score is no known musical instrument. Mahler describes the sound he wants as a short, powerful, heavy-sounding blow of non-metallic character, like an axe blow. For the first performance, Mahler himself had a huge drum specially built to his specifications, but in rehearsals it proved, despite its size, to make a puny little thud, even when the frustrated composer got off the podium and thwacked it with every ounce of strength in his body, causing a good deal of merriment amongst the players. For the first performance, he just used a bass drum instead. Mahler found that unsatisfactory, and we know from an exchange of letters that the Dutch conductor, Willem Mengelberg, had come up with some ingenious idea of producing the sound Mahler wanted, and the composer was very eager to hear it. But we know no more than that. We don't know what Mengelberg had in mind, nor whether it proved satisfactory. For years, I used a large timpani crate that I found stored in the basement of the New England Conservatory in Boston, bashed with a very large lead plumber's pipe. Over the course of several decades of performances, my beloved crate sadly but inevitably fell apart. For this recording, I had a large wooden box constructed, open on one side, which is bashed by that same lead plumber's pipe. I hope the sound would have pleased Mahler. So very quickly, I want to give you a sort of overview of this movement. It begins with a long, slow introduction, full of music of very different kinds, some grand, some very intimate, almost all familiar from having been heard earlier in the symphony. It's very mysterious and full of foreboding. It finally emerges into a resolute march theme that seems to have some newfound courage. The march is one of the key elements of this movement, as it was of the first movement. That yields in due course to another theme that has a rising curve. This music seems to strive ever upwards. You can feel it becoming ever more elevated. But it does not last. The tension is ratcheted up a notch from elevation to a veritable frenzy. then, with great swooshes in the harps, Mahler stops the forward motion, and we find ourselves in a pastoral interlude with cowbells, just like the passages in the first movement. But the music that was interrupted by the pastoral scene returns with ever-mounting exaltation until it reaches its great, horrific climax. The hammer blow of fate has cut it off, and the music is sent scurrying in all directions. After a while, the music rallies, and a courageous march starts up again. This, as before, turns into music of rising spiritual uplift, affirmative, radiantly passionate. Everywhere you hear the rising and falling octaves that we remember from the first movement. It becomes quiet, but with irresistible determination, it rises in a low, slow crescendo towards the second mighty blow. Second time, the music's aspirations have been cut down by this overwhelming hammer blow of fate. And again, the music is sent rushing with horror in all directions. More whooshes in the harps bring a return of the music that opened the introduction. And another pastoral interlude with its characteristic cowbells, and deep bells as well, suggesting church bells heard from a great distance. But pretty soon, we're hearing march rhythms again, more vehement and insistent than before. These marches arches are developed for quite a while and finally merge once more, a third time, with music suggesting spiritual uplift, moving higher and higher in radiant A major. And this time it actually arrives at its goal. It seems that victory over fate has been achieved after all, and then, when victory seems assured, the hero of this symphony is struck by a third blow, the final one, and this is his death. A beautiful threnody in the brass mourns his passing, and the octave leaps that we have heard throughout the symphony seem to find their ultimate consummation as they rub against each other in pain dissonance. I think if you try to perceive the structure of the movement as I have just outlined it, with the introductory material, the pastoral interludes, the whooshes in the harps, the bold marches, the music of spiritual uplift, all leading to the awful truncating hammer blows, if you use these elements as the demarcating points as you listen to the movement, you will soon be able to find your way around in it more assuredly than you might have thought possible.